Marketing is everywhere. From the billboards on the highways to the notifications on your phone, we are constantly bombarded with people trying to sell us stuff. What makes good marketing? Are you doing enough in your life personally and professionally to market yourself? You have questions, and the Marketing Mad Men have answers. Search the Marketing Mad Men on Google or your favorite podcast provider to get practical marketing advice from expert guests who are shaping and reshaping the business world. They say marketing is a madman's game. Join the Marketing Mad Men every Saturday at 4 p.m. to find out why. Those that know me know I'm a mediocre golfer at best, but I love to eat, and I love to drink, and I love this city. Boone's at Bobby Jones Golf Course combines all those things. In town, great views, great food. Today, we talked to their food and beverage director about golf, food, drinks, and some good wine. All that and more today on the Marketing Mad Men podcast.
They say marketing is a madman's game. So now we turn it over to the Marketing Mad Men with Nick Constantino and Trip Joel.
Happy Saturday. Welcome to the Marketing Mad Men. Nick Constantino here, and we got a fun conversation today. For those that don't know, I like golf. It's kind of an all-of-a-sudden thing, and I really like food and wine. So we're going to bring all that together. And to help me do that, I have Austin Riccone, who is the food and beverage director at Boone's at Bobby Jones Golf Course in Buckhead, Midtown. We'll call it that tweener phase, right between
West
them all.
Side,
West Side. just right between them all. For some quick context, as a company, as a radio station, we've done some work. We've done, we had a great appearance with Stuart Sink down there at the PGA at the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame. We've had some different events there. It's been great. And we are also working with a co-collaborator in Firemaker Brewing, who's doing a beer collaboration, which is awesome. So Austin, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing good, man. Thank you for having me.
Oh, great to have you. So let's hit it. So let's start off, talk a little bit about Boone's. Talk a little bit about Bobby Jones. Talk about some of the history of the course, because from start to finish, it's moved quickly. Mm-hmm. And now Bobby Jones, I see, is moving their spread of influence also and buying courses and taking over different courses. So kind of give us the rundown to set up the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, sure. Bobby Jones Golf Course actually opened in 1932, so it's been there for quite a while. And then our president of the board, Marty Elgerson, got this going along with his partner, Chuck Palmer. They run our board, so we are a nonprofit. So they started this renovation, 10, 15 years ago, starting getting the wheels in motion. They brokered a land swap with the state of Georgia and the city of Atlanta. I believe they got a parking garage somewhere around underground Atlanta, and the state of Georgia took over this piece of land. They took over the golf course, created the foundation. It opened in 2018, and the building where I work, Murray Golf House, opened in 2020. So, and then Boone's opened September 2020. Here we are.
Yeah, great time to open.
Yeah, I know.
September 2020. Huh? What was going on then?
Everything and anything. Face masks and curbside and all you can imagine.
Yeah, I'm sure that presented its own trials and tribulations. I got the chance. I don't remember if it was probably 19 because it wasn't during COVID. So mm-hmm. It was probably 19. We knew one of the GMs that was there. He went from Lake Lanier, Legacy Lake Lanier.
Yeah, Brian Connolly.
Brian Connolly. So we went down there, and I saw a lot of the preview of what was coming. Mm-hmm. But the actual coolest thing is I got to use one of the motorized golf carts that follow you, and I got to wear the belt, and it just followed me around. And I figured a way to put a tray on it and had a beer, and it was just following me around with my beer. And I was like, okay, I'm happy. This is all I need.
The tip
so
of the walk.
It followed me around with the beer, and I got to play golf. So that was my introduction, which is a fantastic introduction. So you got... my favorite thing is you got the pitch course, the pitching course. Mm-hmm. You got a really hard putting green to go on. Yates, you got the driving range right there, mm-hmm. and then you got a 9-hole course that can rechange and rejigger, and you can go 18 if you want to. So just set the scenario up of what the course is, and then we'll segue into how Boone's fits into all that.
Yeah. So it was kind of an innovative thing when they opened it. I'm blanking on the architect, Bob Cupp. Marty would hate me if I forgot his name. Bob Cupp designed it. He actually passed during the project, and his son finished it. It was one of the, as far as I know, the first 9-hole reversible municipal golf course in the country. So it was a bit innovative at the time, but they felt like, you know, the property only being about 100 acres.
Yeah.
The old course, I'm sure you may have played, was really tight, really small, tight.
Yeah.
If you didn't get hit by a golf ball, you didn't experience the old Bobby Jones. When they rebuilt it, they decided, okay, you can either renovate the old clubhouse and stick with 18, or we can do a whole new thing.
Yeah.
So Bob developed this reversible golf course, and then we put in the driving range, and to my knowledge, is still one of the only public driving ranges other than Topgolf inside the city of Atlanta.
Sure.
And they were able to put a little 5-hole par three course on the back called Couplings. We have the academy up there where you can come get lessons. You can hit out of the bays on the track, man. So you're hitting out into the range.
Yep.
And you also have all that data you get from Dick's and Academy and all that. Yep. But you're not hitting into a screen anymore. You're watching your ball flight and then seeing the data points.
It's what a lot of these companies are trying to do inside, except with real golf
in town,
outside.
All that fun
stuff.
Yeah,
and honestly, like, as a mediocre at best golfer, I'm already at the point where I'm done with inside. Like, I want to be out there. I'm not like, I care about my swing speed. I just want to go play. I usually have 13 beers while I'm doing it, but I want to go out there and I need to be outside. So I appreciate that because everyone else is trying the other round, trying to cram this in these little spaces and be like, but it's a social club. It's this. No, there's something about being outside. There's something about hitting a real golf ball on a range. There's something about going to a hard putting green, even the pitching, and then going out and playing nine that is still, it's just immeasurably better than sitting inside.
100% agree.
And then you add the entertainment in to have now. Boom. So let's go inside the doors. So you have your clubhouse, you have some offices, you have a restaurant, you have the Georgia Golf Hall of Fame.
Yep.
Talk about that structure, and then we'll kind of talk about your role in overseeing all that.
Yeah, so the whole vision of Murray Golf House was to be kind of the home of golf for the state of Georgia. So you have the Georgia Golf the GSGA, Georgia State Golf Association on the top floor, and the Georgia section of the PGA Tour, so the state-run PGA section there, also in the building, and then the Hall of Fame is run by the GSGA. And then, to the side of that is Boone's Restaurant. So the original idea for Boone's was it was going to be kind of a turn house. You know, they're going to do sandwiches and a small bar and stuff.
Yeah.
And then at some point, Brian and Marty had this epiphany, like, wait a minute, we're in Buckhead. Let's do something nicer. Let's do something for the neighborhood. We're going to create kind of that like country club feel, but that's open for everyone. Completely public, no memberships.
Plenty of parking there, huge for Buckhead. Tennis court, there's more to do there.
You feel that country club feel
without being the stuffiness.
Exactly. Okay. And they ripped up the old tennis courts, built brand new ones up on the parking garage. They wanted to create this kind of like lifestyle destination for that neighborhood. There's nothing like it anywhere. You're out on the patio at Boone's and you're just looking out over this golf course.
The closest thing is probably Ansley Country Club, which is very stuffy, very high to get in, and very pretentious.
Right.
Let's call it
a beautiful golf, but also nine holes. So you're sitting on that patio, you're looking out over that golf course. You see a little bit of the Buckhead skyline, a little bit going on in Midtown, but you would have no clue that you were in the middle of Atlanta, basically. I mean, if you look at a map, we're almost in the dead center of Atlanta.
Yeah.
You can put a bullseye there. So it's just a wonderful experience. And then as far as Boone's goes, you know, we wanted to offer something a bit upscale, but very approachable.
Yeah.
So we're not expensive. We're not fine dining. You know, you can come get your burger, your wings, your soups, sandwiches, things like that. For dinner, we do offer some entrees, but still all that. We're going to lean into more small bites going into 2024. We feel like we want to become more of a gathering spot. We want everybody to come share a lot of dishes and that's really more popular nowadays. People want to order four or five dishes, share, and just have like a communal experience. So we're going to lean into that a little bit in 2024. So, and then obviously the wonderful wine list that we've built over 4 years, all the craft beers. So inside, it's all Georgia beers inside. We got a few macros outside, the Mick Ultras and the Millers of the world. But we really wanted to focus on Georgia-made beer. And as you mentioned before, our partnership with Elliott and Firemaker over there, with Elliott's help, we developed Calamity Jane, which is kind of our house beer, which is just a wonderful blonde ale that kind of hits all the things like a Budweiser or Coors, but it's craft made, it's easy to drink, 4.5% alcohol. I mean, it's just...
We don't even say awesome. Budweiser on the station. You can't say Bud Light on the station. You're not allowed to.
So we'll bleep that out.
We'll bleep that out.
Cool.
If you want my honest opinion on Bud Light, that's not... Bud Light, what they did was not the problem. What you're talking about, the problem. And people actually went to go try a different kind of beer, and they're like, is this what real beer tastes like?
Right.
Why would I have ever drank this in the first place? So because of these craft breweries coming with similar style, approachable beers, but with flavor and depth, that was Bud Light's undoing. Everything else was just the expediter of that whole situation.
Right. But I mean, all these folks around town that are making, I mean, there's over 100 breweries probably just in Atlanta.
Yeah.
I don't know the number, but there's a lot. So we don't venture any outside of Georgia inside. So we want to feature all these guys making these amazing, amazing beers. And then craft liquors. You know, we have tons of cocktails. We're really leaning into Dry January. We're going to debut a new menu actually today with three more mocktails. So we'll have a total of five on the menu. We're just kind of a one-stop shop for everything you need as far as a lifestyle golf experience.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be a golfer to come right. enjoy. Just come on important. Over and just enjoy Boone's.
And you brought up two things that we're going to talk about in further segments. One was wine, which we're going to have a nice conversation about, and two was golf lifestyle, because mm-hmm. those are important things. But in the meantime, tell me who on a Thursday night at 6 p.m., tell me who's coming in. Is it people finishing golf? Is it families in the neighborhood? Give me an idea for who that customer is and what they're looking for in that dining experience.
Well, it's funny you bring up Thursday, because we usually do like a kind of impromptu like golf league. There's some guys that come in. They'll bring a large group. And Wednesdays, we have our own sponsored golf league. So, but yeah, Thursday night, I mean, yeah, you're going to see a little bit of everything you just mentioned there. Obviously, with the sun setting so early now, people are in earlier. But as we move on into the summer and stuff, the later nights, yeah, all these folks coming off the course will come in and surround the bar. We have the outside patio, which is great. We do small bites and beers out there. And then, yeah, we want to do everything from the family to the date night to the birthday. You name it, we do it all. Everybody's coming in.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that obviously you can't run in the red forever, but being a part of a nonprofit and a bigger entity with more at stake and more involved is probably easier than running a high-stakes restaurant for profit with everyone running around hair on fire, having to make rent. I have to imagine that probably adds its own set of challenges, mm-hmm. but alleviates the burden a little bit of the, hey, we can have a long-term vision. This doesn't have to be make profit and do all these things tomorrow. We can have this long-term vision. You got 2 minutes in the rest of the segment. Why don't you close out talking a little bit about that and talk about, as you run it, what's different about running this kind of entity versus just a for-profit restaurant in the middle of Midtown?
Well, I mean, you nailed it. I mean, the one thing we don't have hanging over us is investors, you know, and that's what a lot of restaurants suffer from is those investors coming back.
I have
saying,
to imagine my tax dollars have something to do with this. So I'm going to consider myself an investor for time being. No, I'm just kidding.
Most of our money came from donors,
that's awesome.
Private donors, big business and things like that. But we just answered the board, and the board we actually have a board meeting next week where we'll present our financials from 23, present our plan for 24. And how we plan to just continue to drive. I mean, everything that we have goes back to the foundation. So it goes back to making capital improvements on property, investing in our junior programs, investing in our PGA Hope and veteran programs, investing in our adaptive programs, our academy. What Jason Kuiper and those guys do up there is wonderful. So all of that goes back into investing in basically the community and what we can do to grow the game of golf. I mean, that is our ultimate goal as a foundation, is growing the game of golf. And then Boone's is just another part of that, where we just contribute to the lifestyle of the people coming in to grow the game.
Yeah, I love it. And I think one of the things, so born and raised Yankee, golf was a different thing. Like mm-hmm. I was a football and lacrosse player. We beat up the golf kids. We're like, you losers, what are you doing? coming down here and seeing what golf is, it's unbelievable. I mean, one, playing all year round is just a game changer, right?
Yep.
Because golf, in my opinion, is much more approachable in the winter when the course is yellow and there's nobody there. Because if you're an amateur, you feel less pressure to play. And you have more. I enjoy golf in the winter a lot. But I think Augusta and Bobby Jones and all that history has led Georgia to be such a huge part of golf that it mm-hmm. makes sense what they did. So when we get back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about that and if people are trying to follow this model and dip a little bit more into your role. And you listen to the Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3.
Now back to the Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Madman on Extra 106.3. We are talking with Austin Racone, Director of Food and Beverage for Boone's, part of Bobby Jones Golf Course. We talked a lot about setting up what Boone's is, what Bobby Jones is. So before we get to it, I have two questions for you. Number one, part of any business is marketing. How many people in Atlanta know that story that you just told me? What do you think? Because I had never heard it before. I've even been a part of it. I didn't know all that was happening. How many people know that story, and what methods are you using to get that story out there? Because let's cover the marketing part mm-hmm. before we go on some tangents that I know are going to come.
I have no idea. I would hope that at least 5% of the city knows about us. Now, the full story, I'd be shocked if it was 0.5%.
Yeah.
But that's okay. I mean, as long as they know what we're doing now.
Yeah,
as opposed
I think
to
the cause-based part of it is something that can't be lost, because one of the problems, I believe, is that people think golf is pretentious and that it leaves people out. And I actually completely disagree and think that there's so much money First Tee of Atlanta and all these institutions are putting to make it a more approachable game. Mm-hmm. Use prices on. You can buy clubs for nothing. Courses are $18 to get out. I mean, it is not near as expensive as the people think, but that air of pretentiousness is around it. So I think sometimes you got to be selective in how you say the message, because people think, why does golf need charity? Like, why do these people need charity? So I think that's part of the problem. But talk a little bit about just what the plan is. How are you getting that message out there? Like, I think the marketing part's important.
I mean, we've partnered obviously with Karen West PR, and we're hoping to get more of just, again, the message of who we are and what we do, that everything we do is to grow the game, like we said before. I think that's really our number one thing, and our junior program. And that's all part of, I think, the PGA, kind of their angle. If you're watching golf now and you're seeing all the commercials, like, that's their big focus, is growing the game. And you got guys like Rory and, yeah, and Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas. He's young. Scottie Scheffler.
Now's the time.
Yeah, and Jon Rahm. God bless him.
No matter what you say about Liv, it was the best PR stunt that golf ever had. Because
it really blew
up. You fever pitch. Really blew up. Who cares who merges with who? All it did was bring new people into the sport. You go to a certain course around town, you can't even get on the course. They are so backed up, and it's such a different game of golf.
Yeah,
so
wait till April, yeah, when the Masters is here, Georgia becomes the center, and then we do it again at East Lake, and
yeah, at East Lake, and even Pinewood. It's close enough. That's a people think that that's a home course because it's so close. Mm-hmm. So,
Pinehurst.
Yeah, I told you, I'm new. I'm just getting there. I know there's five of them though.
Yeah.
So the other question, I think, you know, as far as getting the message out there is fine, but when you go every day, when you go into work and you see this stuff, talk about the impact that you're having and you're going to have in Georgian golf. Talk about some of the tangible things that you've seen beyond serving the food in it. Talk about some of the impact that's being made.
Well, Justin, again, I'll keep beating the door down of the junior program. I mean, we were ranked the number one junior program in the state, and I think number seven in the country as far as numbers and quality of players. The academy puts forth so many drive chip putt champions and, you know, the Georgia amateurs and all this. And one of Kuiper's students just signed a full ride to North Carolina to go play golf. So, I mean, you got some real talent coming out of there, and they're just continuing to to push that forward. And then, again, our veteran program, PGA Hope program, is really big. So we'll take a group of veterans over the course of about 6 to 8 weeks. They'll come in for lessons.
Cool.
Take them out on the course. And then at the end, they do like a little kind of a putting championship on Yates, which you mentioned before. They come in and have lunch in the restaurant. And the foundation pays for all of this.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that what a cause. I mean, it's a great cause, but it's also got to be helpful for the future of golf in the state.
Right.
What you're doing, this breeding program, I mean, this is what sports teams have learned. The future is in reaching younger people, you know, the NBA, it's reaching internationally. You are building your future fans in the state, which is also probably part of this whole thing.
Yep.
As much as it's, let's serve this good cause, it's also, let's make sure that golf continues to be what it is. One, which attracts more money into the state. That's why the state, I'm sure, is behind it. They know how much money comes in. But two, you are ensuring your future of this being a golf mecca. Like, we have a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. College football mecca, politics right now.
UGA,
and the state
UGA is
just booming in every direction. So I think it's awesome. So let's get a little bit more in the weeds. Talk about your role as director of food and beverage, because I think it's one of the most misunderstood. I think people think like, oh, it's the guy that just picks the dish. Talk a little bit about your role, how you fell into it, because then we're going to have some fun talking about the restaurant industry, talking about wine, and just going on, again, some crazy tangents.
Yeah, I'm a chef by trade. So,
okay.
You know, that growing up, you know, from the time I was about 17, working in restaurants, washing dishes, you name it, I've done it all. So yeah, culinary school, and then worked around Atlanta
in cool.
some spots. Lived in Napa for a while, Austin,
cool.
Texas for a while as a chef. Came back here, worked at Atlas over
yeah.
right around the corner from where we are now until the pandemic. And then the pandemic hit, and I hit a point where I was ready to kind of get out of the kitchen and start
yeah.
focusing on some other things. While I was in Napa, I did study wine and became
cool.
a sommelier while also cooking. But the beauty of Napa is it's all at your fingertips, so
yeah.
you can literally do it all at once.
Dude, I've been reluctant to go back. So I moved to California in 2004, and one of our first trips was up to Napa. But this was the Napa of old, where you don't have to pay for taste things, and you're just going, and you're just being there
yeah.
trying to get you drunk to buy stuff, which
right.
it's a damn shame that doesn't exist anymore, because like, it's been so, now you have these buses of sororities and bachelorette parties, and look, I don't think wine should be stuffy, but I think that you should be able to taste what you want, to buy things you like, not forced to buy garbage because you're at a vineyard. And I think that
right.
they've gone the wrong way with it, so I won't go back to Napa. But that being said, now all of a sudden you have the chef experience,
mm-hmm.
you have the wine experience, so the director of food and beverage makes a lot more sense.
Right.
So talk about your day-to-day and the role now, and mm-hmm. what you do, and what you think that role is going to look like going forward.
Yeah, you know, I met Brian and Marty, and they brought me in, and our visions aligned for what we thought would go there. What we do, I started out as what Brian Conley called the chef and bee. So I was actually the executive chef and running kind of the whole restaurant
sure.
when we first opened. But once we got going, I was able to hire a chef kind of step back a little bit and focus on the business. So, yep. Yeah.
So you helped build the menu and everything. You did all that stuff that executive chef would do.
Built that place from scratch.
Good.
Yeah. Now Chef Jason does a lot of that. And yep. I just kind of.
Because you got to change. You got to right. change. No matter what you do, yep. just because you're a non-for-profit does not mean you have to change. And what you said about small plates, restaurants, no matter what, people's tastes are not what they used to be, where they want that same experience. They want that fresh experience. Otherwise, you're going to yep. lose them. So that's why there's a new one, and that's why you're constantly changing, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a spot for those places out there where the menu never changes for two or three decades.
Yeah.
You know, that is still important. But I think the majority of people, especially in Atlanta, which is a great food town, they're looking, they want to go to the same spot because they might love the venue or the service or what have you, but they're going to get bored of the if you just serve them the same stuff for five straight years. So we're constantly looking for the next thing. You know, we do have some mainstays on the menu that are really popular
sure.
that we don't want to change. But
sure, and a
things...
lot of those are because you're at a golf course. You have to have right. certain things. I imagine a turkey club, it shows up. Like, I mean, there's certain things that
no,
you just
have. Don't have a turkey
something
club,
like
actually.
It, though. But something like it.
yeah.
There's a turkey. There's some kind of sandwich that you can bring out on the course with you. You got to have that one thing.
Funny
that
you mention it because we will have one coming here in the next few weeks.
Predicting the future on the Marketing Mad Men.
We continue to kind of push and change things around, which is why we've had this conversation. You know, we've been a little slower. This is kind of like our off season because especially yeah. our tie into golf. You know, as it slows down through the holidays, the weather gets cold, the days get short. We have some time to reflect.
Yeah, and people also realize how much money they just freaking spend on gifts. They're not
right.
as likely to go out. They're on some kind of dry January. They're trying to lose. Like, so I can imagine January is a regroup
yeah.
time.
The yeah. whole industry right now is just kind of like taking a breath. But yeah, it gives us a chance to plan for the future. We're going to plan for the years. We're gonna look at things that worked in 23, things that didn't work, and we're going to push and try to make things work for 24. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah, oh no, you're all good, man. Honestly, so it's more the director, the role, because right, like here's let's like ask you a question. So, are you doing the ordering for the food, like the back end stuff? That's off your plate
yeah.
now, because that stuff is tedious and all. So now your vision is how are we using our food and beverage to get the most people in there and keep the most people.
Right.
I have to imagine.
I do monitor everything that comes in and out of the building, though. Yeah. So there are plenty of times when something comes in, I'm going to chef and be like, hey, what's going on here?
Right.
Hey, this price changed dramatically. So I am tracking everything. I don't want to get into the weeds of all that. But yeah, I have things where I track money in, money out, day to day.
Well, and the reason I'm asking is let's segue now. So
sure.
talk about the restaurant industry. So I'll tell you, last night, my lovely niece, Alina, who's here, who is videotaping for mm-hmm. us, she's doing a mini internship with us. She's staying with us. So I got to go out with my wife for the first time in a while. So we're going to go to this restaurant. And I'm like, you know what? Let me just look at the menu. They changed their menu. They took what was a chicken shawarma for $13 and now $27. So I look and I go, No. Mm-hmm. So I found another place. So
yeah.
the restaurant industry is facing headwinds from all angles.
Yeah.
The beer, spirits, and wine industry that was funneling a lot of that growth, putting marketing dollars in, they're having their own problems.
Pulled back a lot.
Yep. They pulled back a lot. So what headwinds do you see the restaurant industry facing? And are you guys kind of held out from some of that, or are you feeling them also? And what do you think the 24 is going to look like?
We've absolutely felt that.
Okay.
The price increases on everything was just so dramatic. I mean, we had prices of things like steak and fish going up 2-3 times. Where we used to pay $15 a pound for something like a center cut filet is now 30, 35 a pound.
Good. It's the worst cut of meat there is. Get a better cut.
Yeah,
go get a hanger steak and do me a favor. Let's make this. Let's do this
hanger
the right
steak
way.
Is actually on the menu, sir.
But it's cheaper per pound for sure.
It is cheaper, yeah. but it is twice as expensive as it used to be.
Yeah,
so
it sucks.
Yeah, and it's one thing about restaurants that we as the industry would love to tell our customers, but you can't. The customer is right. Right.
And they don't care. they don't care because most of them. My only thing is most people who are the biggest restaurant goers probably are not buying their own hanger steak at the store
no.
to know that correlation.
Right.
And those sensitivities are a little less. I'll give you an example. Like the Cab Farmers Market where I shop for my hanger steak has not changed in a price per pound, which is insane. Because for me, it's like, well, how much money were they making off me before this happened?
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, I don't think most consumers care or want to know about that nuance. Otherwise, they'd be cooking.
It's so funny because you'll actually overhear conversations at tables where people in whatever industry they're in, they could be lawyers,
right.
whatever.
They're
and they're talking about inflation and wages and my paper is more, this is more. And then they look at the server, how can this be so much more? And you're like, we're all affected by it, man. Like
more so, actually, because you're talking about goods that were affected by the war in Ukraine. You're talking about goods that the weather can be an influence. The weather's not an influence on what lawyers do, but the weather can be an influence on a full crop or what happens with the cows. Or there's a million inputs and outputs.
And most of our product is perishable. That's the other problem. You know, the things that we bring in, there's a shelf life. So yeah, you know, copy paper sits there forever. Pens, what you know, whatever they need. But it has been a struggle, and especially trying to pay living wages, because I'm a big proponent of trying to take care of people. So how do we pay more without charging more is like the hardest thing you'll ever try to figure out in this industry.
Yeah. And how to get them, because ultimately you could be the best chef in the world. If their experience with a waiter or a maitre d' or someone is off, the experience is negative. So the back of house, I always joke, like, people, if you've never seen the back of the house, then don't judge the front of the house.
Right.
Because people don't even understand how important the dishwasher is, because no one has enough plates to do a full service. If someone's not washing plates the right way, that can delay every other process.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not the chef's fault. It is the congruity in the back of all of these things happening together. And if you've never worked in the service industry to some capacity, then you probably shouldn't have an input into what's going on here.
The smallest things can derail everything. And it's funny, you mentioned the best chefs in the world. A lot of them are actually moving out of their a la carte restaurants and moving on to research and writing books and things like that, because they'll even say it's become too hard.
Yeah, even restaurants, they go into the airports and do like a burger place in the airport as opposed to having a restaurant, which is easy, banging out quickly. Yeah. And it's a shame. But that being said, I do believe most times in most cities, all the restaurants are opening on the same restaurant. There's too many of them out there. And we're just at a point now where you're at that point where you're going to see people fall off, and then the industry will reset itself. And that's why I'm asking, because you've had experience on both sides. What do you see 24 looking like? Take yourself out of your role for the rest of the industry, especially in Atlanta.
We're hoping to see a big rebound. You know, 23 was tough with obviously the inflation. We're teetering on the edge of a recession. You know, everybody was panicking about all these different things. A lot of people weren't going out. We had so many people inquiring about events and then backing out, be like, we're not going to do it this year.
Yeah.
We're just going to have a small thing at our house and we'll call you next year.
Yeah.
So we really took big hits, especially on the event side of things, because they just weren't booking as much as they were in 21 and 22. 22, we saw this like the big revenge.
It's the pent up. The pent up demand caught up.
We had all these like receptions from people who got married 2 years ago and all that stuff.
So you're thinking that it might be kind of like a reset, right?
I think we're going to go back and see some 2022 numbers.
The pandemic, I don't want to say it's out of mind, but that shock to the supply-demand curve has adjusted itself out, and you can see at least more consistency and at least more you'll be aware of what's going on, as opposed to those ebbs and flows and the shocks to the system.
And the pandemic just reset everyone's mentality about how work should look.
Yeah.
You know, all these people that worked in our industry, the hospitality industry, took the biggest hit when the pandemic hit, because everybody got out of it, and then 6-8 months later, they're like, why was I being abused so bad for so long for so little money? I can go drive a truck. I can go back to school online. I can do any number of things where I don't have to deal with rude people and make the same amount of money.
Unfortunately, I think it's swung too far the other way, and now nobody wants to do anything and be paid an exorbitant amount of money.
You know,
so I think it'll catch itself in the middle at some point.
We're seeing a big resurgence in labor, to be honest. I would say 2022 and early 23, we'd put ads out. You'd get 15 or 20 applicants, and you were lucky if anyone even showed up for an interview. The last times we put things out, I think the last time we put a cook ad out, for example, we had over 200 applicants, and we had 5 legitimate people for one role.
That's because the government stimulus ran out. That's because those fears that businesses were feeling finally made themselves down. Mm-hmm. You don't know if this job is going to be here. Get in somewhere. Put your time in.
Right.
And I bet you that those the chefs and the line cooks and the servers are people that felt that first, because they're most beholden to tips and external factors.
Right.
And if the restaurant's down, they feel it. And that's, I think, one of the good things about being a server. Like, you're based on how many people are coming in. So it is your incentive to be a good steward and patron of your restaurant.
Yeah, it's not unusual for servers this time of year to pull 2 or 3 jobs, because they'll just pop around. Like, I'll go, these guys are busy for breakfast. These guys are busy for dinner. These guys are busy on the weekend. And they literally know where to go.
But probably doesn't hurt you, because ultimately, as long as they're good stewards for your brand, if you're not serving breakfast, then who the hell cares?
Right. I'm very supportive of all of it. If they're like, hey, you know, look, you know, we're just not doing what we were doing in the fall. You know, I'm going to go work over here part-time. I'm still going to give you this amount of hours. You know, when March hits and we pick back up on events, they come back full-time. You know, sometimes they go find a better gig, and they're like, you know, hey, I like it better over here for whatever reason. So they go on, and you know, we'll pull somebody up, or we'll elevate someone. The beauty of our part is we do have our BevCart program, so we'll have a lot of these young people come in, and they kind of ride the BevCart.
Yeah,
they serve, and then they're like, hey, I might want to come in the restaurant. We're like, yeah, come on. You know, we'll train them. And people can learn to do more things, get a lot of experience. And a lot of them are just in high school and college.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they have bigger aspirations moving forward. But they can learn, you know, how to work hard, how to interact with people, and just kind of how to hustle.
Yeah.
You know, how to make money working hard. That's what restaurants teach you.
Yeah.
It's how to make money. And that's what I learned young.
Yep.
And it really will serve you in the long run. You learn how to deal with people. You learn how to deal with frustration.
Yeah.
You learn patience.
Yeah. Rejection. And then one of the things I love about love about any tipping industry is not to judge a book by its cover, because there are sometimes, so I was a personal chef for a little while in Vegas, but I ran a valet business also. And sometimes the guy in the Lamborghini tips less than the guy in the Pinto.
Yep.
And it is fascinating to see how every person interacts, and it makes you understand how business works and why you should not automatically assume anything about people. And I don't think there's a better industry for that than someone in the service industry to some capacity.
Right.
Right? Restaurant industry's got to be a great one to see those things.
And a lot of people that worked as yourself, that worked in the industry and then went on, you know, some of these people made money doing whatever, opened a business, created something. And we have a lot of these people that come in. We have a couple that comes in, they buy the same bottle of wine every week, and they will tip $100 almost no matter what, you know. And obviously we know who they are. We're going to provide good service, and we try to, you know, we're not going to show them any better service than anyone else, but they know what we do. They appreciate what we do.
Dude, regulars don't mean the person who tips the most.
Right.
Regulars mean that understand the business. Like, one of the things I always get angry at, and it doesn't happen around me, because I'm like, if you are ordering a steak and you order it medium well, it can't go backwards.
Yep.
So under order it, and at the very least send it back and say, hey, can you cook this a little more? That is not a burden on a restaurant.
No.
What's a burden is recooking a piece of meat because you're a moron and don't know the difference between medium and medium well.
Right.
So I think the etiquette is really gone off. Everyone's a freaking foodie. Everyone thinks they know everything. Everything's got to be organic. Dude, no one in America can take an organic piece of a non-organic and tell me the difference between them. And if you could, you've been in that industry your entire life, right? It's the same as wine, which is why, again, natural segue.
Okay.
So let's have some fun. Let's talk some wine. So you're a sommelier. Mm-hmm. I am a, I think connoisseur is probably, I am a enjoyer of wine. Second I turned 21, went to Napa, had a rich girlfriend whose dad introduced me to like the bourgeois of wine. This dude was so badass. I remember one time we were at a restaurant, we were running an hour late. He calls in, they go like, sir, we can't hold the table for you. There's no way. He goes, hey, do me a favor. What's your most expensive bottle of wine? Put it on the table for an hour. I'll be there in an hour, and hung up the phone. I was like, yes, that was awesome. So this dude got me into the Opus One and the Rothschilds, and I started tasting. And my personal belief is the difference between a $5 to $10 to a $15 to $20 is there. About 30, it caps off, and then you don't see that difference again until about the $90 bottles. And I'm talking from retail.
Sure.
I don't think the difference between a $30 and a $60 bottle is difference enough to justify that 30. I think when you start getting to that 90 to 100, you can kind of taste that difference.
Right.
Is that completely based on nothing, or do you see some kind of agreement? Because of your industry, I know you're not allowed to reveal the industry secrets, but curious more for an insider point of view.
It's not completely off base, because that higher price point is probably going to show that they're picking from a more prestigious vineyard, or they are putting more hands on the product, meaning they are picking the very best from multiple vineyards and putting it into a single bottle. You brought up Opus One. That's what they do, right?
Yeah, opposed to the $60 bottle, which might just mean more marketing versus the $30 bottle.
Possible, yeah. It could mean better artwork. It could mean a thicker glass bottle.
Got it.
It could mean greedier owners. I don't know. But, you know, we do a lot of tastings in our restaurant, and from where I came from in Napa too, you know, I don't want to go too long, but when I was the chef because I did work a Michelin star restaurant in Napa, and as the chef there,
which restaurant?
Latoque. Okay. In the city of Napa.
I was lucky enough to spend time at Bouchon with Thomas Keller.
Okay, right.
So I know a French line. I never got to go there, but I got to spend time with the highest up at Bouchon in Vegas, which was a secondary restaurant. Mm-hmm. So that's why I asked, because I love.
We probably don't have a ton of time. I actually had the pleasure of going there. I could talk about that experience. But my experience with Latoque, the owner there, he gave us money every year to go eat at these places. So I got to eat in a lot of 3 Michelin star restaurants and have those experiences. But anyway, as we were developing recipes and dishes for that restaurant, you always had wine in mind. So every time, and we had, you know, 20, 30 items on the menu. It was all tasting menus and different level, you know, chefs tasting, vegetarian tasting, everything. But so you're constantly coming up with probably 2 to 3 dishes a week.
Yeah, and you need pairings for each one
too.
You
have to, no such thing as that. That's where I was going with the story, is you could spend a week or two pulling in the best food products in the world, pulling all my staff on it, you know, really dedicating all my time to it if I'm not working the line and doing everything else I'm doing. And then you put that dish up in front of chef. Chef loves it. You put it up in front of the somm. He puts 8 wines in front of it. He says, I can't pair this.
Done.
It all goes in the trash. You start over. You might not ever bring that dish back. And it was just the most frustrating and humbling experiences of my life when I first started experiencing that. So, but at La Toque specifically, and then, you know, again, the laundry and some of these other places, the wine pairing is in itself an experience.
Yeah.
So you can have fantastic wine and love wine. You can have fantastic food and love food. But when you put wine and food together, they both go to another level.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's amazing. I didn't even know that until I experienced that. And one of my bosses actually just went to 11 Madison Park. And
yeah,
he came back he's like, he had never had that sort of, he's looking at me with wide eyes. Like,
dude, that's been a top 50 restaurant in the world for like 20 years, 30
number
years.
Number one.
Yeah.
And they got there and then they closed it down and changed everything. They're like, oh, we're the best. So let's do it again. But the conversation with him, he's looking at me, he's like, I had no idea. He's like, I know, like, it's beyond eating. It is a full-on experience when you're at these places. It's theater.
Yeah.
It will literally change everything you think you knew about food and wine.
San Francisco is probably the second closest, but you're not going to beat New York for that. You're not going to beat New York for that.
You know, and Chicago's got a future.
Chicago's really that gastro kind of the more nouveau. And, you know, my what I personally think, and we're going to keep talking about wine after, I think there's going to be a resurgence back to old world techniques. Mm-hmm. I think we've gotten a little too fancy, a little too froofy, and I think that there is going to be a back to basics, the hearth fire, and feeling like you're in a house. Because, man, you walk in, these people want organic this, and they're just not thinking about the right things. Like, was this a high quality piece of meat? Was it cooked without too many additives and extra stuff? And I really, really want to see that go back. And that's really, I think, why I like a lot of ethnic cuisines. And I hate using the word ethnic, but I love Basque food, and I love going to a real old school Spanish restaurant, and even French. I don't particularly like France because of the butter and everything. Everything is just doused to the core in cream and butter, which kind of makes cooking a lot easier. But I think we're going to go back to that. And what I'm hoping is that the wine kind of follows that, right? Everything's got a different kind of wine, and everything, it's about the labels. Yo, how about put good wine, quality wine, like you said, picked the right way, into a bottle and let me enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with a house wine if love went into making the house wine.
Right.
And I think, and I kind of see that resurgence coming back. So we're going to talk a little bit about this after the break. Nick Constantino and Austin Racone, and you've been listening to Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3.
Now back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Marketing Mad Men on Extra 106.3. Austin Racone from Boone's at Bobby Jones Golf Course is our guest, and we've covered a lot of topics. And for the sake of just keeping this mad, we're going to keep going down a rabbit hole here. So here's what we're going to do, bud. Sommelier, restaurateur, cook, chef, all those things. I'm going to throw out some dishes that I make in my house. I want you to give me wine pairings that come off the top of your head.
Okay.
Okay, got it? Cool. All right, let's do it. Chicken marsala.
I would probably go white, Chardonnay.
Okay, Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A heavy Chardonnay.
So salty, rich, so you put some with a little
minerality,
sweet balance. And
maybe a little bit of a mallow on there, yeah.
Okay, sticking with Italian. One of my favorites, chicken parmesan.
Chicken parmesan. I'd probably go Sangiovese, something light and red.
Okay. Okay, maybe, Sangiovese, because I would say like a light Super Tuscan, but they don't make a lot of light Super Tuscans.
The beauty of Sangiovese is it's got a little bit of that tomato kind of back end note. I think it'd probably go pretty well.
All right, so let's do, we talked about before a break, duck cassoulet.
Honestly, I'd go Spanish. I'd go Tempranillo, Rioja.
Okay, I love Rioja. It's probably my favorite, and we just booked our trip to Barcelona, so I know that I'm not in the region, but I'm in the place where at least I can get it, which is going to be amazing. What about something like a tom yum soup, like a Thai? You got a lot of sour and a lot of
whatever you go
earthy
sour
flavors.
And spice, I'd go Riesling, go off dry.
Okay, so, and Riesling is another one I think is very misunderstood as to be sweet wine. Most Rieslings from across the world are not necessarily sweet.
Oh,
they're light-bodied.
Yeah, they're completely dry. But for something, whenever you go a little bit of spice, Thai, something like that, that little bit of off-dry, that little touch of sweetness, will
never. I'm going to throw in that on that note. I'm going to botch it, but Grüner Veltliner.
I love Grüner.
Those are like a Rioja to me, except it's got a little bit more of that bite to it, which I think would go well with that. Yep. Again, I'm not even sure where it comes from or if I said it right, but I've had enough of them to know that really complements intense flavor because it's light and subtle but gives you a little kick.
You got it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. What about barbecue? What about, let's do a Georgia one. Talk about some barbecue, some brisket.
Beer.
Yeah.
If you're going to go wine for barbecue, you got to go big, heavy red.
Yeah.
I'd go like
Zinfandel,
Napa.
Big Zinfandel.
Yeah, Napa Cab, Napa Zin. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and it's funny because because the meat is so flavorful itself, yeah. And then you're going more flavor on flavor. That's such an American
thing.
You
need something to stand up to it, and only Napa red wine would have that ability.
That's such one of the funniest things, my wife always gets into this conversation, and it is, to this day, not many things she's ever said piss me off more. She goes, I hate Merlot. I go, honestly, that is the most ignorant, stupid thing I've ever heard a person say. I go, there are 8 million Merlots in the world. You can't hate them all. Just because you had one Merlot that you did not like doesn't mean you hate Merlot. You know, it's such a diverse wine.
Anybody who says they hate Merlot, go get them a Bordeaux. Just a Merlot blend. That'll be their favorite wine in the world, and you turn the bottle over, 70% Merlot.
Well, I do know that one of the things about when you talk about Napa is the soil and the sediment, the rocks are very similar to what happened in France and in Bordeaux region. So that's why there's similarities
Napa
there.
Napa has something like 80% of the world's soil all in the valley, which is one of the reasons why it's one of the best wine growing regions in the world.
Yeah. All right. So let's do something like a Greek food. Let's talk about like a shawarma, something like that.
Whew.
We're going exotic on the spice palate. Maybe Moroccan or something. Let's go exotic.
I still think, if it's going to be spicy, I think you got to go off dry. So I'd probably go back to a Riesling. Maybe a Tokaj from Hungary.
Okay. Nice big piece of whole roasted fish.
I'm going to go against the grain here and go Pinot Noir.
Ooh, I like that call. I would say for me, it has to be the right Sauvignon Blanc. It has to be very dry. I don't need a lot of plum and all that stuff in it, or a really made the right way rosé, because it is so overdone rosé. It's disgusting. A real French-based rosé, I think, goes really well with it also.
Yeah, Provence. Sauvignon Blanc, I like to stick to more salads and more crisp things like that.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that no one eats salad on Let's Listening to this show, so we made it easy.
That's why you go to a tasting menu. You have to eat it at the first, and they'll bring you the Sauvignon Blanc with it.
Honestly, when I go out to eat, one of my favorite ways to judge a restaurant is by their chicken and by their salad.
Yeah.
One, the chicken, because everyone can make meat taste really good. A real good made chicken is very hard to do. Yep. And I was told that by many chefs in my life. And then salads, because everyone makes the same salads. A new kind of salad with a lot of vegetables and nuts popping out and dark cheeses and a lot of that stuff, I like that, because I'm not making it at home, because I'm not going to find the ingredients to pick them off to do those things at home.
What you learn in our industry is, especially with salads, is textures. So you always want to throw the nuts or the Parmesan crisp, something in there to throw a little bit different texture on there while you're getting it in.
I actually think one of the biggest differentiators between people who understand food and don't is texture. Mm-hmm. Like you're searing a piece of meat to lock the juice in, but also that difference of texture from the crust on the outside to the marbling on the inside is something that I think palates really enjoy if you like that stuff. But
I'll give you two things that would change a home cook's life: salt and acid.
Yeah.
The biggest problem home cooks is they don't season their food. They go so easy on the salt or no salt at all, and they wonder why their food doesn't taste as good as a restaurant. It's because we are, call it, heavy-handed with salt.
Yeah.
Like we season.
And isn't it also about, is the Maillard effect, if I'm right, that makes the browning? The salt is what starts that.
Browning of surface sugars.
What's the one? There's an effect, from what I understand, when you put salt on something and you roast it and it gets that browning on the outside, that reaction doesn't happen without the salt being on it. I forgot what it was called. It doesn't matter. We're going really into the weeds here, as I thought we would do. And honestly, vinegar changed my life.
Yep.
Understanding that a champagne vinegar and all these different things and cooking wines,
and
how
so
much
many
it could,
flavors of vinegar,
but how much it could change the you could still use acid. Lemon's fine, lime is fine, but like anyone who thinks lemon and lime taste the same, they do not. One is sour, one is bitter. They're just once you start getting into that world of vinegar, because what it does is it cuts back on fat, it cuts back on sugars, and then I think fresh herbs are the other one that just, and I mean fresh herbs, like they're very easy in Georgia to make in your garden.
Oh, to grow.
Put a flower pot outside.
Grow them inside.
Thyme, I think everyone wants a rosemary tree. I don't use rosemary that much personally, but I think thyme, parsley, oregano, basil a nice sweet basil. Mm-hmm. You want that aromatics.
And there's a million different varieties of basil.
I love Thai basil personally. I think it's just
lemon basil is one of my favorites.
So anyway, okay. So to end this, we have about 2 minutes left.
Okay.
One of the things that I find fascinating is the blend of golf and lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I think, again, Liv sped a lot of that, but a lot of it is emotion. I think Top Golf has helped that. I think just the game, starting with Tiger and getting younger, has helped that. But I believe what you guys are trying to create is a lifestyle brand with golf as a part of it. Not necessarily a golf course, a lifestyle. that golf tends to be a part of. So talk a little bit about that. Talk about it, because I think it's a trend that's going to continue, and then we'll close out the show from there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic really set that off, this athleisure, you know, when everybody's working from home and Lululemons blew up in the world and everybody wants to be comfortable. Yeah.
No one's going back to hard sole shoes ever, dude. You put Cole Haan's or Pilar Molar shoes on one time and get away with them at work, don't wear hard sole shoes. It's insanity.
Yeah, you know, we're wearing Allbirds and Nikes and things around. I think it's just golf lends that sort of leisure like lifestyle. Like it's not a fast thing, right? You go, you hang out, you know, you walk the course, you just enjoy company. Where, you know, football is king in this country, everybody knows it. But and you know, baseball right across from Truist, you know, everybody loves baseball. But you know, golf just brings a different style of sport. It's still competitive, but you can do it by yourself, you can do it with friends, you can do it competitively, you can do it for fun. It just really opens everything up. And honestly, you know, as a father of a young son, you know, I know my wife's saying no football, so we got to get them into something. You know, sports just, they lend a teamwork, they lend a discipline and dedication and things like that. So we want to bring all these families in. We want to show them that you can just come over and experience all these different things on our property. And we're not going to rush you. We're not going to, you know, force anything on you or anything like that. So it's just a good spot.
Love it. So tell everybody how to find you. Tell them how to find you on socials. Go to the website to learn about all these different things.
Yeah, boonsatl.com is a website. You can go on there, make reservations, check out the current menus, and also book an event if you're interested in that. And we're on Northside Drive, just north of Collier Road,
yep.
Peachtree Battle area.
Yep, easy to get to.
Easy to get to.
Of the highway, you can come up 85, yep. You come down 75, easy to get to.
Yeah, you pop out right there, right behind Piedmont
Hospital.
About
the socials?
Instagram, boonsatl, Facebook, boonsatl. Yeah, we're easy to find. Put it into a search bar, it's all going to come up.
There you go.
Yep.
So you've been listening to The Marketing Mad Men with Austin Racone. Thanks for having me. We'll catch you next week.
A lifetime of hard work. Children laughing in the kitchen. Family photos on a restaurant wall. A legacy that lives on. It all comes from the power of a conversation. Like the one Tommy Hall had with First Horizon Bank about taking over his father's Charleston-based restaurant business. Now the table is set for a whole new generation. First Horizon Bank. Let's find a way. Go to firsthorizon.com/Tommy. First Horizon Bank, member FDIC.
Marketing is everywhere. From the billboards on the highways to the notifications on your phone, we are constantly bombarded with people trying to sell us stuff. What makes good marketing? Are you doing enough in your life personally and professionally to market yourself? You have questions, and the Marketing Mad Men have answers. Search the Marketing Mad Men on Google or your favorite podcast provider to get practical marketing advice from expert guests who are shaping and reshaping the business world. They say marketing is a madman's game. Join the Marketing Mad Men every Saturday at 4 p.m. to find out why.
Hey, sandwich lovers. Today's your lucky day. There's a whole new way to roll for lunch or dinner delight with Nucky's Hoagies in the Roswell Corners Shopping Center. Now open. Nucky's Hoagies in Roswell is family owned and operated by the sub-sisters, Stacy and Shannon, whose love language is food and Nucky's Hoagies, their passion. When you bite into a Nucky's Hoagie, you'll taste the difference. The softest hoagie rolls ever, along with hunger-quenching sandwich combinations. Make Nucky's Hoagies in Roswell on Woodstock Road your new favorite spot for lunch or dinner.